rate, debate, create.
I am ready too. So, hello, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome to Rate, Debate, Recreate. I'm Sammy Purcell.
And I'm Logan Keller. And this is the penultimate episode of the season.
I was about to say, like, this is the ninth episode. We're almost done. Oh,
yeah. My God.
What are you guys going to do without us?
I don't know. I know what I'm going to do.
That's it. I don't know. I am going to rest.
Yeah.
Rest, some rest and recreation, as Phoebus said in Hunchback of Notre Dame. But anyway, Logan, I have a question for you.
Yes, Sammy.
Who is your favorite historical figure?
Wow, that's a big question.
It's very broad, I know.
Wow. Do you have one to buy me some
time? I don't really, actually. I actually think Harry Houdini is kind of a fun one. Also, Rasputin, he's pretty fun.
Yeah, I was going to say Judas is kind of iconic.
Judas is iconic. Oh my God, yeah. This is a tangent, but I had to do... So I write scripts for Watch Mojo, and...
I know.
And one of the categories was the most unforgivable, like, the most unforgivable things that happen in, like, musicals or something like that. And I was like, well, Judas, literally, the original unforgivable act. Although I guess it was forgiven, because so were we all, but whatever.
You know? Is that the context, though? Like, is it the character's choice? Or is it like, this musical can't be forgiven for making this decision?
So it was both, you know, so like, because they said that one was good, and I was like, thank God, I think that's funny.
I do think it was good, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, so sorry for that tangent, but if this is your first week of the show, welcome. Just to explain a little bit what this show is, so each week, Logan and I pick a show based on a category. We rate that show on a scale of 1 to 10. We debate which one is better. And then we think of one aspect that we would change and we recreate it. So, like I said, each week we got a category. And this week that category is historical figure cameos. And
I love this category.
I know. I actually had a really good time, especially in the recreate section, which we'll get to. But my show is Ragtime.
And my show is Something Rotten.
Oh my gosh. What a combination.
Yeah.
So many historical figures to talk about, particularly with Ragtime. It's a little...
Yeah, in both though, honestly.
Yeah, in both.
But only one actual character, but there are a lot of references in Something Rotten to historical figures.
And I like to imagine that the historical figure in Something Rotten, that's exactly what he acted like in
real life. Yes, oh my God. It's like... wow, this is, I can't think of what I'm thinking of, but like, do you ever just see something and that like replaces your vision of, like, okay, for example, this isn't the original one I was thinking of, but like Celine Dion.
Sure.
Celine Dion to me now is Marlon Mandel in Titanic.
Yes.
Like, that is Shakespeare in Something Rotten.
No, it's perfect because like, I just think that Aaron Brockovich looks like Julia Roberts because I love that movie.
Yes, that's Aaron Brockovich.
Yeah. That's what she looked like. All right, should we get into some summaries, which might take a while for me. I don't know how you're doing over there, but let's get right into it.
You got 3 hours.
Okay, thank you. That's how long they took, so I feel like that's fair. This is straight from Wikipedia. I'm kind of going to go through that and then try to go through the story as best as I can. So... Ragtime, it's a musical with music by Stephen Flaherty, lyrics by Lynn Ahrens, who we just literally did another one of theirs, Anastasia.
Yes.
And the book is by Terrence McNally. It's based on a 1975 novel of the same name by E.L. Doctorow. And it's set in the early 20th century, so the turn of the century, and tells a story of basically like three separate groups in the United States. So you have... African-Americans who are represented by Cole House, who's a musician in Harlem, as well as Sarah, who is his love interest. Then you have kind of upper class white people who are represented by Mother. None of them have names. Mother, who's like the matriarch of this family, who includes her younger brother, her son, Edgar. He is the name, I guess. And father. And then you've got another group, which is Eastern European immigrants who are coming over at the time, who are represented by Tate. Is that how you say that name? I couldn't really even hear what I was watching.
Yeah.
Tate.
Audio wasn't that. It was a ragtime stuff to get through in general, and the bootleg we watched was
was 3 hours long with not great audio.
And, like, didn't help,
Yes. So, he's a Jewish immigrant from Latvia. He shows up with his daughter, Leah Michelle. and they're trying to make their way as well. And the show also, a la The Category, incorporates a ton of historical figures, to name a few. Harry Houdini, Evelyn Nesbitt, Booker T. Washington, J.P. Morgan, Henry Ford, Emma Goldman, Matthew Hinton, just like all these jokers. All right, so I'm going to try to quickly go through the whole thing because I want you all to suffer as I did. I'm sorry, that was rude. But so short as I can, we start with mother and her family. So father has gone away on an expedition to the North Pole with this guy, Robert Peary, like a famous explorer. So he's gone. And while he's gone, mother finds a black baby in her garden. Turns out this baby belongs to Sarah, who in a fit of desperation, we'll talk about this whole thing later, has tried to bury the child. Mother ends up taking Sarah and the baby in, and Sarah's lover and the baby's father, Cole House, starts coming to the house every day, basically to try to win back her affections. And he eventually does. And then father comes back and he's like, what the fuck is going on here? And Cole House and Sarah at the same time are frequently accosted by like this racist group of firefighters in the town who at one point destroy Cole House's very fancy Ford car. And while he's trying, you know, going about his way to get legal retribution for that, he keeps running into issues and he like wants to stave off his and Sarah's wedding while he like tries to fix it. Sarah attempts to go get help by running into a rally for a vice presidential candidate. We also talk about that because I'm a bit confused. And trying to ask for help. And she ends up being killed by police, which sends Cole House on this whole, like, understandably head-tail spin. He and mother's brother, who is this kind of, like, radical revolutionary type, end up taking over J.P. Morgan's library in New York City and threatening to blow it up. Father is called in to help because he knows Cole House and the brother, and he calls in Booker T. Washington, who comes to convince Cole House that this, like, isn't the way. Because Cole House is, like, he looks up to Booker T. Washington, which they kind of, like, talk about through the show. Cole House, like, sees the light, quote-unquote, and agrees to call it off, but is shot and dies as he leaves the library. Meanwhile, on this other side of the stage, we have Tate and his daughter, who is played by a baby Leah Michelle in the 1998 Broadway version. They've just arrived in America. They're having a really hard time making ends meet. He ends up meeting mother and her son Edgar at one point, and they like bond a little bit. And then he ends up being involved in what was a real strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, called the Lawrence Textile Strike or the Bread and Roses Strike. And him and his daughter end up fleeing from that and go to California, where he ends up becoming a wealthy filmmaker, spoiler alert. And he meets up with mother again in Atlantic City when they both, like, moved there. And then at the end of the musical, there's, like, this little epilogue. So father ends up dying on the Lusitania, and mother marries Tate, and they adopt each other's children, along with Cole House and Sarah's son. And that's it.
That's all it is.
That was pretty fast, right? Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
That was good. No, that was good.
Okay, so I'm going to give Ragtime 6 out of 10. Warn the Dukes, which is something that Edgar says to Harry Houdini because he's clairvoyant and I guess and knew that Archduke Ferdinand was going to be murdered to start World War One. Don't understand why that's in there at all, but okay.
I'm also going to give the show 6 out of 10. Warn awesome. The Dukes. I feel like we've been pretty aligned on our ratings this season.
Have.
Okay. Side note is. Is this show, like, a Mandela effect? Like, am I wrong in thinking that this is, like, one of the shows in musical theater that I think people love? And it's not that good.
Listen, we're blinded, which we'll talk about this, blinded by the music is a thing.
Yeah.
Because the music is great, I think.
Yes, I agree. The music is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I just feel like We if you talk haven't seen about it, Ragtime like it's like one of the best shows ever, and it's like straight up not.
I know, and I think it's so it has it. It's only been revived once.
Yeah, for, in like 2010.
Yeah, 2009. So like I don't think it tours a lot, and it's not like it's done in high schools. So like we don't actually have a lot of opportunities to see it.
We really heard Audra McDonald sing Your Daddy's Son,
and we were all like, "This is a masterpiece." She blinded us. She blinded us to the truth. But yeah, that's what I got.
Cool. Okay, let's talk about something rotten. So, Something Rotten tells the story about the Bottom brothers, Nick and Nigel Bottom. I thought that was just totally like a joke to be able to do bottom and top jokes, sure. Which they certainly do. Apparently, Nick Bottom is a real person that was like basically the jester character in a lot of Shakespeare's stuff.
Cool.
I don't think any of this story is real, but apparently him as a human was real.
I think it was the omelet musical.
Yeah, that
what
was
did you
real.
Do? Did you
I
drop
just
some?
Knocked over like this trash all over my feet.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, it's a story of the Bottom brothers who are basically trying to write like the next big hit following Shakespeare's success with Romeo and Juliet. And they're like kind of stuck for a few reasons, like funding, ideas, all this stuff. So Nick goes to a soothsayer who's the great grandson of Nostradamus. I forget his name, but it's like something like Kevin Nostradamus, or like a regular name. And he's trying to see like into the future to see what Shakespeare's biggest hit will be so that they can like do it first. The soothsayer basically gives, first he says that the next big thing is a musical, and then he says, he like basically gives a mistranslated version of Hamlet, and like it's omelet instead. And the whole, like there's just all these comedic like mistranslations of Hamlet that end up in the show Omelet. So basically Something Rotten explores like the creation of this new show. It, like, really comedically portrays Shakespeare in this, like, cocky, plagiaristic light. This is now the definitive Shakespeare.
Yes, this is
And also is, like, the relationships that are affected by Nick, like, as he's, you know, struggling to make all this stuff happen and neglecting his brother and wife, etc. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's the basic premise. I'm going to give Something Rotten 8 out of 10 tap dancing eggs.
Well, we can end the show, because I'm also going to give it an 8 out of 10.
Yes! Love that. Not to publicly advocate for bootlegs, but one thing I love is, like, this show, the bootleg is called Tap Dancing Eggs, the musical, which honestly could have been an alternate name to Something Rotten.
I was lucky enough to see this on Broadway on a trip to New York with my sisters, and we didn't know a ton about it. And, like, it's not, like, I don't know, it's kind of like we were talking about with Spamalot. Like, it's not, like,
yes,
a high art. And I remember coming back from that trip, and like a week or so later, I was in Dr. Love's class, who he taught the American Musical Theater class at where Logan and I went to school. And he brought up Something Rotten and was kind of like, like stupid, like very deriding of it.
Yeah,
and I was
remember
like,
that.
I had a great time. I just thought it was super fun.
I agree. I saw the tour of it. And I don't know if I've ever laughed harder in a show or also been in an audience that was like so like infectiously laughing throughout the entire show.
I think we might have seen Dear Evan Hansen the same trip, and it was the juxtaposition, or maybe did it come out before Dear Evan Hansen? Maybe.
Yeah, it did.
Okay.
It came out while we were still in college.
But okay, yeah, then we didn't, because I remember seeing Dear Evan Hansen and the whole room is like sniffling and sobbing, like literally like making like deep throated sobs, and in this one it's like the total opposite. Like we were just, everyone's cracking up.
It's joyous.
Fun. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like, you know what, Dr. Love, maybe it's not the best you know, use of the medium of musical theater. Yeah,
it doesn't have that Codgers and Hammerstein integration.
And sometimes you just want to go in a theater and laugh for 2 hours.
Sometimes you just want to forget about life and make fun of Shakespeare.
Sometimes you just saw a 3 hour show and could barely get through it, and you need to laugh for 2 hours.
You just need some fun in your life. Okay, we'll talk about that 3-hour show. So, Ragtime. Interesting financial history with Ragtime. So, the original 1998 production received mixed reviews. So critics noted the dazzling physical production. It had a $10 million budget, including, you saw it, like that big old car and fireworks. Like, it's very
kind of like Miss Saigon vibes.
Yes, but like not Andrew Lloyd Webber. So I didn't expect it. And he's not Miss Saigon, but you know what I mean? Like the whole, So basically the critics at the time were basically like, everything, it's so flashy that it's like trying to make you forget that the script kind of sucks. And it was not financially successful. And a lot of people think that it probably led to the end of this company called Livent, which is Live Entertainment Corporation of Canada. So Ragtime started in Toronto. This is a Toronto company. And they were very famous for like over the top lavish productions. Their 1994 revival of Showboat was the most expensive production ever at the time. I don't think it is still, but it was at the time. And their founders, Garth Drabinsky and Myron Gottlieb, ended up going to prison for fraud and forgery because they doctored financial statements. So,
yikes.
Fun times. And then, fast forward, so the 2009 revival, so 11 years later. So this production also had a large cast and orchestra. Like, there's a whole Wikipedia section for this show's orchestra. Like, the orchestra's a big-ass deal. And also resulted in basically a financial loss. Like, they just couldn't, they could not make back the money with ticket sales, and the show like didn't really survive. So Ragtime has like an interesting financial history that I will get into in a minute. I'm gonna go through a New York Times review from Ben Brantley, but first I just want to say, so I'm not negative the whole time, I think everyone in this cast is a fucking star.
Yes, truly.
Like, listening to Maren Massey and Brian Serks Mitchell and Audra McDonald, like, I could listen to everyone sing for hours. So many talented people. When Audra McDonald and Brian Serks Mitchell came out and sang Wheels of a Dream at the Tonys, I, much like everybody else in the audience, was in tears. So, like, there is something very magical about this music, specifically. So, for most of my section, I'm just going to go through this New York Times Ben Brantley review, and then I'm going to talk about the kind of separate stories and why I think they don't really work. So I'm going to start with this quote. So he says, there's so much to admire in Ragtime, from its images of hand-tinted, I don't know how to pronounce this word, daguerreotypes? Sorry if I just made myself sound like an idiot. Sure. Brought to exquisite life to the electric presence of its leading man, Brian Serks Mitchell, as the Black revolutionary Cool House Walker, but there is finally little to fall in love with. Which I think is really right. Like, I can imagine, like, sitting in the audience and being kind of, like, overtaken by everything that's going on. But it's also, like, hollow at the end of the day. And there's something that he sort of gets into with this review that was also bothering me as I watched it. So the story itself, right, is, like, about innovation and kind of, like, critiquing this obsession with, like, this kind of idea of progress, like the veneer of progress, like what kind of like wanting to look at what this veneer of progress, like what ugliness is it hiding underneath. And I think the story does its best to like actually look at that, and I haven't read the novel, I don't know how well it does it, but like kind of look at that theme through the stories of Tati and Sarah Kohlhaas, although I think both those stories are flawed. But by that token, like, reading about how much the production itself was marred by, like, financial troubles and how the production design was so expensive and lavish and, like, duh. Like, it feels really short-sighted and, like, not self-aware. And the production itself was so, like, corporatized. Like, to want to, like, critique this, like, you know, faux progression while doing that just feels wrong to me. Like, it just like clashes, and I'm very surprised no one said that.
Firefest vibes.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note it's the same season as The Lion King, which like, what can be more lavish than Joy Taymor's The Lion King? But it doesn't feel the same. Like, The Lion King is The Lion King. It's Disney. It's Elton John. It's big, big, big. You know, this is like trying to critique that while doing it at the same time, which doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think maybe if they tried, like, this wouldn't, like, fix the script problems, but maybe if they tried, like, a slightly pared-down version of this, which it doesn't sound like the 2009 one was, like, it might not make me feel like I'm watching something that, like, fundamentally doesn't get understand what it is. What it's supposedly trying to say.
Yeah.
So that's, like, sort of that section of it. And now I just kind of, I'm going to be kind of fast today because I just think a lot of stuff is wrong.
Sometimes quick episodes are good.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about Sarah and Cole House first. So the destruction of Cole House's car, I think, is a thing that really, like, thematically, from what I just talked about, made sense. Like, that's, like, his veneer of progress. Like, he thinks that if he can, like, buy this stuff, like, look the part, like, you know, he dresses really nice, and he, like, he thinks if he does that, he can, like, lift himself out of, like, being the subject of, like, racist abuse, right? Like, mm-hmm. At least I think that is what he's, like, trying to do. And so, like, destroying the car is destroying that idea for him, which I actually think, like, I like that thematically it really works. And his, like, idealization of Booker T. Washington, I think for the beginning of the show really works. So, like, Booker T. Washington, he famously gave this, like, Atlanta Compromise speech that we, like, studied a lot. But he called for, quote, black progress through education and entrepreneurship rather than trying to challenge Jim Crow segregation and disenfranchisement of black voters in the South directly. So basically he was like, let's try to grow parallel instead of like mm-hmm. trying, you know, which a lot of other black leaders like W.E.B. Du Bois were not interested in that. So like not interested in kind of a faux separate but equal kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think one of the issues I have with the Sarah Cole House story is I think the script wants to have its cake and eat it too, and it's like impossible. Like, so I think one of the things that sort of works is having Cole House be invested in like the ideas that Booker T. Washington is putting forth. And one of the things I think really works is right after the car is destroyed, like the guy who's playing Booker T. Washington comes out and kind of like spouts like these ideas about like patience and, you know, just wait and like da 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 da, and you can see like Cole House's like gears turning, like that's not gonna work, like mm-hmm. Sarah's dead, they're ruining my car, like that's, I can't do that anymore. But then to have like Booker T. Washington come back at the end and be the one to convince Cole House to stop and like invoking his son, like what would your son think about this, like etc., it just is difficult because Cole House ends up dead. And I think like that is saying something a little bit, but at the same time, the way that the second act plays out, I think the writers are sort of like, how do I say this? It feels to me like they are supportive of this idea of like nonviolence, nonviolence, nonviolence. And then having their cake and eating it too by having Cole House finally pick that and then ending up dead, which I'm just like,
I think it's lacking nuance. Works. Like this, I think that like, I'll say, like my whole life, I was like a pacifist. I was like, nonviolence is the answer. There's never a reason. And I think like the more I have grown and learned and like educated myself, I think that another parallel factor to violence is power. And I think that there's a difference between, like, someone with power inflicting violence on someone without it mm-hmm. versus someone without power inflicting violence on
as the a person.
Yeah, as like, a response to this. And, so I think it's lacking that kind of understanding and nuance of, like, when violence is necessary.
And I feel like, what am I supposed to take from, like, okay, so I feel, because he's saying, like, Brian Stokes Mitchell sings Make Them Hear You, which is, like, this, like, very, oh my God, like, give me chills, like, very powerful, and he, like, absolutely just, like, his voice destroys is incredible, yeah. He destroys it, so he sings that song, and you're, like, I'm with you, man, like, sure, like, you know, he gets you there, and then he walks outside and dies, and I'm, like, what am I supposed to take from this? I don't think they, like, like you said, it's just not nuanced enough, I don't think. And then I kind of have, like, the younger brother character, who I think is a really strong singer. What is that guy's name? It's like,
The actor or the character?
The actor. The character's younger brother. Maybe Peter Friedman? I'm not sure if that's Tata, actually. But anyway, that guy is, like, an incredible singer. And I feel kind of weird about, like, at the end, they're like, oh, he ends up going to fight for Emiliano Zapata. And it's like this idea that like, okay, like, so like the white radical guy is like afforded the opportunity to like go fight, but like the black radical guy, he dies. But at the same, and like, I think like, okay, like you could like maybe make like a interesting comment there, but at the same time, I think it sort of uplifts the younger brother as this like paragon of like radicalism in a weird way. Like he's the one who has to like convince Kohlhaas to do this, or like, can, you know, like it's just very strange. And it's not like, he's not like a particularly well-written character. Like none of them are, which brings me to Sarah, who I just think is severely underwritten. Like you said, like we heard Your Daddy's Son and we all were like, wow, this must be the best, best for like the best like role in female musical history. It's definitely not. We barely learn about like the conditions she was facing that led her to do something like fairly, and I don't have a problem with like having a character do something like that, like, you know, trying to like bury a kid alive. But we don't learn like anything about what has led her to do this, or why. Like with Kohlhaas, like all we really hear is like he wasn't faithful. That's really it.
Yeah. Like,
and he was on the road a lot because he's a musician. I don't know anything about like her support system, which I guess she had none, but we don't know. Like we don't learn anything about it. And I don't really understand why she takes Kohlhaas back. Like there's no real, except I guess like if Brian Sykes Mitchell fell to his knees and sang it like that, it I'd be fair. Like, sure. Like, okay. I feel like you're forgiven, it's fine.
That's explanation enough.
But like I don't really understand why she finally decides after him coming to the house every day. And then to get into Tata, who I'm very sorry, I think I'm just pronouncing that wrong, but I think his story suffers just from this musical being overstuffed. Like we said, it's 3 hours long, and I actually think he has some of the most like emotionally moving moments in the show, like gliding when they're on the back of that train. Our children, yes, is like beautiful, but gliding like particularly got me this time when they're on the back of the train after the strike with him and baby Lea Michele. But I think
this is Lea Michele's best role.
She's actually very good.
She is great.
But it's sort of a weirdly sanitized immigrant story, I think, and not like in a way where I think like anything is like necessarily wrong. It's just like, or like not like they took like any of the horror out of it. Or anything like that. It just like takes place outside of all the rest of the main characters, basically, except Mother crosses in and out sometimes. And because the show is 3 hours long, I think they're just like, we gotta like keep running through with this guy. So like everything happens very fast. And then he just like shows up and he's like, hey, I'm rich. like we don't, you know, like we get like little kind of like hints that like he makes those like shadow books with the like silhouettes that you can like turn, you know, when you make pictures and you can make them like look like a movie. Like he makes those kinds of things. So we have like little stuff like that, but I just think sort of a fast story.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I want to say is like, considering how uneven the rest of this is, we've been saying this whole time, it is wild how much I love the music. Like I just want to like run through some of the songs from like the middle of the first act to the end of the show, because it's incredible. So you've got Your Daddy's Son, New Music, Wheels of a Dream, which I think basically go like 1, 2, 3. Maybe there's a little bit in between Your Daddy's Son and New Music, but like that, what the fuck? And then you've got The Night That Goldman Spoke at Union Square, which I think is a banger, Gliding, Till We Reach That Day. Okay, end of act 2, end of act 1. Kohlhaas's Soliloquy, Our Children, Sarah Brown Eyes, He Wanted to Say. Sarah Brown Eyes, He Wanted to Say, Back to Before, I think is another 1, 2, 3, where I'm like, what is going on here? And then, like we mentioned, Make Them Hear You towards the end. So it's just crazy to me. I think we've all just been blinded by
music. I'm like, well, now that you're saying, though, like, tickets were so expensive, it wasn't, like, open for that long. Maybe everyone just heard the music and thought it was fucking incredible, like myself.
Yeah, and everyone who lived in New York see the show. In 1998 was like, you guys, no.
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything you said. The score is impeccable, like truly as close to perfection as I think you can get in musical theater.
Yeah.
And the cast performing it, oh my God, like it's a beautiful mix of like talent and writing and orchestrations and everything. But the show itself, I'm like, maybe this should have just been a fucking concept album.
That would have been great. Like, when they sang Wheels of a Dream, I was like, if y'all don't fucking stand up and clap, I would be losing my mind. It's so good. Oh, my God.
Awesome. Anything else?
No. Should on to greener okay. eggs. Yeah.
Greener eggs and Hamlet. Oh, my God. Okay. My thoughts. I'm also going to be a bit brief, not for any reason, just I think that, like, I have some things to say, and that kind of speaks for itself. I don't know. I really love this show. I, again, like, just like last week, one of the themes I want to talk about is just stupidity.
Yes.
I think this show is delightfully stupid. I know I talked about the significance of, like, stupidity on Broadway and how I think there is a place for it in Spamalot. And I think this show is another show in that, like, same caliber of, like, the Book of Mormon, producers, mm-hmm. Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Spamalot, where it just is so fucking dumb. And, like, honestly, like, it almost feels like a little insulting for it to be on Broadway, but, like, that's kind of, like, why it works, you know? Like, it's
Dr. Love.
Yeah. But, like, by being, I don't know, like, I do feel like there is some, like, BDE going on to be like, yeah, I'm gonna put this on Broadway.
This fucking, like, thing. Yeah.
The same year, yeah. As I'm pretty sure this was the same year as Fun Home. Like, you, yeah. Like, to have those juxtaposed together.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of part of what Broadway is and should be.
There's
and like is
for
able
everyone.
To. Exactly. So yeah. I love that. In fact, I'll to talk about Something Rotten and Spamalot together, I was reading a lot of, like, reviews when Something Rotten came out, and, like, so many of them compare it to Spamalot.
Yeah, of course.
In the type of humor it is. And I agree with that. And while I do think the show feels very Python-inspired, I will say I do think it's able to differentiate itself enough to, like, stand as its own piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, like, the dumb British wordplay humor is there. And I also think that Something Rotten has its own elements of humor and dumbness that feel unique,
yeah,
to Something Rotten. Like, this is, I mean, Shakespeare's characterization I think is so spot on and
perfect.
Hilarious.
Love
yeah
it.
Perfection. I think B's storyline really differs as, like, the basically the only woman in the show than Lady in the Lake does. Mm-hmm. Like, have a super diva, like, high strung kind of person, like almost like a Liza Minnelli act,
yeah.
Compared to, like, B, who has, I think, has a little more nuance mm-hmm. than the Lady of the Lake does, and, like, trying to, you know, blend in as a man to, like, you know, is a product of
the
her time.
Boy, some me.
Yeah. And, like, also is, like, passes better as a man than, like, her husband and his brother. Also, Heidi Blickenstaff is just phenomenal.
Oh my God.
I'm
She's
such
so
a fan
good.
Of her.
Yeah.
I saw her in Jagged Little Pill and oh. Title of Show. She's just so, I,
She's awesome.
I love her so much.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the stupidity is great. I think the premise is fucking hilarious.
Me too.
I was thinking about this when I was watching it. I was like, I honestly feel like, so there's the, people who did the music and lyrics are, like, the had the OG idea for the show, and they're brothers. And I honestly feel like they just, like, got stoned one night and were like, oh my God, what
Hamlet.
If someone misinterpreted Hamlet as omelet?
Because,
like, also ham, I'm like, that's how I would probably pronounce it. Omelet, like, if I was thinking
really?
Like old, if I was thinking old English,
okay.
Like omelet, like, I don't know.
I guess.
And they just, like, had that stupid-ass idea and literally were like, let's fucking make a musical around that. Like,
love it.
I think that this is both works in its favor and is a slight critique or detriment of it, which is that, like, I really feel like the whole show kind of revolves around, like, that one joke.
It is. They maybe a little overstay their welcome with that one gag.
Yeah.
But
it's a little one note at times.
Yeah.
But at the same time, one thing that I think is kind of genius about this show is that, like, based on this premise, they have two, like, unbelievably huge troughs of stuff to pull from,
mm-hmm.
which is, like, the entire works of Shakespeare and the entire Broadway library.
Yeah.
And boy, do they fucking do that. I think that this allowed them to get so creative and, like, I think that, like, obviously a lot of Broadway shows want to have, like, show-stopping numbers, but, like, no show, to me, is able to, like, if you're literally, their whole point was to create a showstopper that pulls from showstoppers.
Yeah. Which, maybe in that respect, like, they had a little bit of a leg up, because, like, when,
yes,
you know.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's, they do. That I think that's my whole point, is that they do have a leg up, but in their defense, they fucking cash out on it.
They
don't leave a single cent unturned. Like, they really...
You'll give us your, like, money.
any musical that was not referenced in a musical, sure as hell is referenced in Make an Omelette.
If you were mentioned at all, irrelevant. You better...
Truly. Like, this is the burn book of Broadway. Speaking of which, a musical and Make an Omelette are both so unbelievably funny. But when I saw it, both of them got standing ovations during the show, which is crazy because neither of them are, like, act-ending numbers. In fact, I said this, I don't think I've ever laughed so much in a show. So it's I just love that about it. Okay, want to move on to the casting of this show, which I think is another, much like Ragtime, is fucking genius. Christian Borle...
Perfect.
What?
I saw him. Okay. He was great.
I don't know if this is your experience with Christian Borle, but my introduction to him was Legally Blonde.
Yes.
And, like, that was kind of my main, like,
which,
Christian,
like,
Borle.
Like, standard, like, Emmett is such, like, a, yeah, standard leading man. Like, you like Emmett.
He's,
like,
yes, and he's good, but, yeah, like, I don't think he did anything stellar in the role of Emmett. Like, don't get me wrong. I like him, but it's, like, he's also not supposed to be, like, a scene stealer. I have since, like, become more acquainted with some of Christian Borle's other work in Spamalot, in Something Rotten.
Wasn't he in the Peter and the Starcatcher's play?
Yes, that's his other Tony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also saw that with my mom when we went to New York in high school, and he wasn't in it, but that role is, like, so hammy. And I'm like, really? So he's just a ham, but the first thing I saw him in, like, was not very hammy at
exactly,
all.
Yeah. The other one that I saw him in, like, a month ago was in Little Shop. He, honestly, was probably the scene stealer of Little Shop.
He's a dentist, right? So,
like, yes, he's a dentist, but also plays, like, every other side character. Oh. He had the audience in the palm of his hand. Like, yeah. I truly, Sammy, I really haven't seen such a, like, he controlled the audience. Mm-hmm. And he would lean into it. Like, when he knew he really had us, he would keep going and going.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there were bits that, like...
That's why live theater is so fun. Because if the audience is reacting, you know you can keep pushing.
And there were moments where it was so clear that, like... Where, like, some things landed the night I saw him in Little Shop that, like, maybe landed more than usual. And he, because, like, the other actors around him were, like, struggling not to laugh. Like, he is truly a comedic genius, and I had not viewed him like that. But, wow, he is amazing. Yeah.
He's equally
Brad Oscar, the other standout to me in this, both of them were nominated for Supporting Actor, Christian Borle won. Mm-hmm. Brad Oscar is amazing as Nostradamus. Heidi Blickenstaff as B was phenomenal. Underrated, I think John Cariani, who plays Nigel, the older brother.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I thought he was so funny in his characterization. I was like, no, like the classic younger brother.
Yeah.
I thought it was amazing. The version we saw had Rob McClure as Nick Bottom, but originally it was Brian D'Arcy James.
I saw my man.
Really? Okay, I want to hear your thoughts because the Times kind of had a little sass and kind of did him a little dirty.
Here's my thing about Brian D'Arcy James. We take him for granted. We take him so he is dependable. He's gonna be good. He's always gonna be good. And I think he's not, like, I mean, he was Shrek, but his cover to makeup and stuff is Shrek. He still walks around like that. I don't think he's a very flashy performer.
Yeah.
So I think in a show like this, you got Christian Borle fucking hamming it up. You got Nigel's here. Everyone, Heidi Blickenstaff, we're all being hams. I don't think it necessarily works if you don't have him sort of being normal.
Yes, I agree.
Like, you need someone, and he is so dependable at, like, being the straight man, I guess, in this instance at least. Like, he is just so reliable, always really good. People seem to really like him. I think he's, like, a well-loved person in the industry, at least from what I've, like, seen and viewed. I love him. I think he's underrated. Underrated King. Underrated King George. and I do think he needs to be, like, a little pared down in this role for it to work as well as it does.
I've only seen him at the Tony Awards performing for Something Rotten, so I really can't speak to his performance. But from what I know and what I've seen of him, I don't know. I feel like he would do a good job. I do think Rob McClure was fantastic.
Yeah.
Who also was in Little Shop when I saw it as Seymour.
Aww.
but, yeah, I don't know. The Times did not like Brian McKee James in this.
I ride for him all day. Underrated. Every time he shows up in anything, I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
Thank God.
I'm never sad to see good him hands. In a show. Yeah. Okay, two more things I want to talk about. First is just like the choreography, the set, the costumes are really so fun. And I also love how it's like really intertwined with the story. Like the overly big, like, I don't know what they're called, the like penis covers.
Sure. Okay, we can call them that.
But like basically, like it's on purpose that like basically everyone has a huge bulge because it's basically like a pocket that goes where your crotch is that everyone's holding, and they like use like when Nigel is flirting with Portia, like is like rummaging around for his sonnet, but it looks like he's like jacking off to her right there. it's like so all intertwined, like the costuming, the choreo.
Mm-hmm.
Hilarious when they do their like chorus line bits, and it's really also just like really great choreo overall. We want more Tap on Broadway, like, please. Come on, like Tap is dying on Broadway, and I need it to be more of a front and center thing.
Tap is back.
And yeah, I think that like this kind of goes without saying, but I'm gonna say it, like where this show shines the most is in its like farcilicious big group numbers, like again, a musical, Make an Omelet. Even, like, the Welcome to the Renaissance, like, that is when the show is in its element. And I do feel like sometimes the, like, in-between moments, it does lose some of that momentum. Mm-hmm. Which brings me to the last thing I'm going to talk about, which are, like, my critiques of the show. Which aren't really that deep, but, like, I do have some. This might defy my whole, like, stupidity belongs on Broadway argument, but, like, while I find the show fucking hilarious, I do think it's rather lacking in, like, any message.
It's
just funny. Yeah. It's just farce. And like, I do think that even Spamalot, which I think was even criticized for lacking kind of a bigger meaning. I do think even Spamalot has like a semblance of that. Like,
sure.
There is the whole like hero's journey motif of like, you know, going through finding yourself and coming out a better person for it. I don't really think that Something Rotten does that because Nick never really has to face any consequences for his actions. Like, he basically treats everyone like shit.
Yeah.
He, like, tries to plagiarize. He steals money from the money box. And then, like, the worst he gets is, like, B basically makes him admit that he does that and then saves his ass. There's not really, like, any consequences.
And you don't care because, like, Shakespeare sucks too. You're like, yeah, whatever.
Yes. Yeah, so, like, I don't know. Maybe they don't, like, they literally just wanted pure comedy, pure farce. But I would have loved something, like some kind of, and I also think like, I think that farces, like we don't think of them as having meaning, but I think oftentimes the farce itself is like critiquing society,
mm-hmm.
which like, I don't think is necessarily the case here. It just is like musicals, Shakespeare, ha ha ha.
It is like designed to make you laugh. It is like a turn your brain off thing. Like,
yes. Yeah. Which like I love, and I do. I think that like what would make it go from like good to great or like great to like iconic is some kind of substance that it's missing. So that's my main critique of Something Rotten. Other than that, it's so hilarious. I also know it's a pretty common show that like does the tour round. So like if you ever have a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. Yeah. The energy in my audience, at least when I saw it, was, like, so, it's the type of show where you feel connect, like where the audience is a character almost. And I love that.
It's great. Yay.
Shall we do some recreating?
I'm actually very excited. So yeah, we should. So as we know, Ragtime is a musical about the turn of the century and includes very important historical figures from the turn of the century.
Yes.
So if we were to make a musical about this turn of the century, so like the 2000s turn, who would we include? So I asked Logan to make a list too, but for this, I narrowed down categories for the different historical figures that appear in Ragtime. So I'm going to say what the categories are and who I put in that category, and then I'll do who mine are. Okay. So you have the staying power star. So that's Harry Houdini. We still know who Harry Houdini is, right? People talk about him. We know who he is. All right. You got the Flash in the Pan, Evelyn Nesbit. Never heard of her until this show. You got the political figure. So I kind of grouped Booker T. Washington and Emma Goldman together for this. You've got the billionaire, J.P. Morgan. I don't know if he was actually a billionaire in 19th or 20th century money.
He would be today.
But he would be today. The innovative industry man, Henry Ford. The artist, this is maybe a stretch, but I said Stanford White, he's an architect. That's an artist, you know?
Yeah.
The nepotism baby, Henry Kendall Thaw, who was the son of a railroad mogul, I think. And then the explorer, Robert Peary, who's the guy who took the North Pole expedition. Okay, so for my turn of the century musical, my staying power star is...
Wait, should we do each one at a time?
Oh, or... yeah, that'll be fine. Okay. So, staying power star, mine is Celine Dion.
Mine is Celine Dion also.
Oh, let's go. Holy crap. She popped off in 1990. Yes,
that it was has like her era.
Yeah, it has the Las Vegas feel, magic, Henry, you know? I'm like, maybe yes, that works. Okay. The Flash in the Pan, David Schwimmer.
I said, no, I didn't. okay. This is so dumb, Sammy. I said Cisco, who he's the thong song guy.
Thong song. Dumb. Thong.
But I was that's true. Kind of a one-hit wonder vibe.
It took me a minute to remember who you're talking about, so yeah. But David Schwimmer, he was the most famous friend, when it started and when it ended, I think. People were oh, he's the one who's gonna take off. Where's that? What's happened? Not that he hasn't done some stuff, but I think most people would be that's Ross. And I don't think 100 years from now we'll be David Schwimmer.
The only other thing I've seen Cisco on is an episode of Cribs.
There you go. It's probably a good episode.
It is a really good one.
All right. So political figure. I said Linda Tripp, who allegedly secretly recorded Monica Lewinsky's phone calls to about her relationship with President Clinton.
I said Bill Clinton / Monica Lewinsky.
Okay. So here we go. Because I feel like our political life is defined by scandals now more so than ideas. So I went in that direction. Okay. Billionaire type. I had trouble with this. I said Warren Buffett, which
me
like,
too. Oh. He was just the billionaire of the 90s though.
I feel like that's who I remember as being always on the richest man list. So I'm just put him in there. Okay. Businessman innovator. I said Steve Jobs.
Me too. Oh my god. I said, okay. Maybe this isn't that crazy because
No, that's my other choice was Zuckerberg, but so somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Artist. I said Spike Lee.
Oh, that's good. I said this is kind of a stretch. It's a little more 80s than turn of the century, but I do feel like it persisted through the 90s. Keith Haring. I feel like I associate the 90s with that style. Holding hands around the world.
That's okay.
And
Spike Lee maybe was in the 80s, so that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Nepotism baby. I said Paris Hilton.
Paris Hilton.
Daughter of a mogul. And then
London Tipton.
Yes, she is an icon. And then for Explorer, I said Chris McCandless, who is the Into the Wild guy. You know that guy who...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because there aren't, that many
honestly,
explorers.
That's kind of... Mine's not that different.
Really?
I said Elizabeth Gilbert, who's the Eat, Pray, Love.
She, at least she didn't die.
I almost said Dora.
Oh, you should. I think we've got a pretty good musical.
I think so, someone too.
Write it for us. All right. You go.
Okay. Well, I wanted to, that's a little similar. I wanted to recreate Something Rotten. And Something Rotten is, it takes place during the Renaissance. And Renaissance, Beyonce's album, Act One. So I have a whole thing. I mean, this isn't my theory alone, although I did think of it independently and I see it later in a TikTok. But my theory with Beyonce's Act One Renaissance is that she's going to do Act One Renaissance, Act Two Enlightenment, Act Three Revolution. So I wanted to do the Enlightenment version of Something Rotten. So my Enlightenment, basically, I'm just going to, like, redo some of the, like, people and plot elements of Something Rotten with the Enlightenment. So first, William Shakespeare becomes Jane Austen.
I love it already. I'm on board.
So her Romeo and Juliet, aka, like, her springboard to making her successful, Sense and Sensibility. And then her Hamlet, or Something Rotten, is Pride and Prejudice, or Pies of Nemesis, in honor of Sweeney Todd coming to Broadway this season. The show will also, like, heavily spoof that, so, like, making pies of their nemesis instead of Pride and Prejudice. Nice. And then, lastly, their big number, Make an Omelette, is, this is so dumb, is Bake a Pieval. Like a pie rival. So it's like, basically the whole thing is like, you got an enemy, put him in a pie.
Oh my God.
And it's bake a pie.
It's like bowl. Dark Waitress.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So yeah, basically the premise is they create a musical of Jane's future biggest work, Pride and Prejudice, but it's mistaken as Pies of Nemesis, as in they're making pies of their enemies. So yeah,
it's like
that's
Arya.
It.
It's like Arya in Game of Thrones. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I love it. I am a big Jane Austen gal. I'd watch that.
So. Yeah, I would too. Next, we'll need to do the revolution.
That was so much fun.
Yeah, this was a fun episode.
All right. Should we preview next week?
Yeah, this is the one I'm most excited for by
you
a
get
miles.
To say it. I'm
okay,
so
thank
excited.
You. Okay. This last episode, the category is, and we want your guesses on this one, the category is supporting actor Zac Efron helps solve racism.
Oh, yes, he does.
Let us know what you think it could be.
Two guesses, which shows?
And we'll see you next week as we talk about Zac Efron and the shows that he started.
All I've ever wanted.
That he's got a supporting start in, I guess. Bye.
Bye.